Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 21st, 2006. Today's Elder Hostel session is entitled Medical Ethics, Ethical Dilemmas in Modern Medicine, presented by Cliff Hall. Let's listen in.
Health and health care, and the determinants of health. We talked about aging successfully the second session, and I was flipping through some notes last night, and I came across this little note that was sent to me by one of my patients. Probably 15 years ago, a lady by the name of Ann Mills, who was probably in her mid-80s at the time. And I would always ask my older patients, you know, what are the secrets to, you know, how come you're doing so well? All of you could have answered this question. But she wrote this note, and I kind of saved it. The little bird on it, she knows that I like to look at birds and things. Just a really sweet lady. So she put her seven rules here, and I just thought I would share them with the group. Rule number one, follow the advice of a knowledgeable and caring physician. This lady knows how to get good care, you know? She says something nice to me like this, and, you know, the next time she calls, she wants to get worked in for an appointment. Oh, yeah, Ann, right in. So she's no dummy. Marry one who is kind, amenable, generous, and loving like Bill. And I took care of Bill as well, and he was all those things for them. They were a great couple. Be consistent with an exercise routine. And we certainly talked about that. Lean heavy on the wholesome foods. Avoid stress. And this is what I like. There's always tomorrow to do what you can't do today. And it isn't that crucial anyway. Life has its limits, so enjoy. Her sixth point, find satisfaction in whatever work you choose. The choice is largely one's own and supplemented with doing for others and an enjoyable hobby. And don't expect, and she listed this, and don't have these high expectations, to avoid adversities, perfection in yourself or in others. And I think a lot of wisdom from this lady just sending me a little note. She just signed it, Ann. I just want to share that with you because there's a lot of wisdom out there if we look for it and listen for it. We started a discussion about spirituality and faith and religion and medicine, and we talked about the general sense that people who do have a religious bent, who do take part in religious activities, who pray, generally have a better health status. And there's a lot of possible reasons for that. We talked about community, participation in the community, healthy habits, positive beliefs and positive emotions, tendency to follow directions and first thing she says, follow the advice of a knowledgeable physician, you know, that's, and that there are some biochemical and biological correlates of that is that if you have less stress in your life, you have lower levels of stress hormones, your immune system functions better. There are reasons why that may be translated into better health. And that studies, it's across religions. It isn't just Christians that get the benefits of that. It's people of the Jewish faith or Muslims or whatever, if they do have a religious tendency. But we also point out there were some negative aspects of religion, too, and that one has to keep that in mind. Negative on a personal point of view, such as refusing to take a blood transfusion. We talked about things of that sort. But there are also some big negatives, whether we talk about the Crusades or we talk about the Inquisition or we talk about religious wars that have gone on. And many people look at the current wars in the Middle East as primarily religious wars. And to the extent that that's true, that obviously has a huge negative impact. And to the extent that that religious wars foster increased expenditures on military, that's less that we have to spend on other health-promoting activities. The second part, that was the part, does the spirituality affect health? The second thing that we were going to discuss was, does intercessory prayer play a role, and does it work? And I was going to present some scientific data, some studies, some observations about whether it does or doesn't. I don't even think that's appropriate. And I don't think it's appropriate because I don't think that religion is something that people are going to test with the scientific method. And I don't think that we can deal with religion or prayer in a way that that we can say it's just is it just another risk factor for disease? I mean, should I be telling my patients when they say, you know, what should I be doing, doc? And I should say, well, you know, you should exercise, stop smoking, eat right, fasten your seatbelt, believe in God and go to church. I mean, is that something I should be saying to people? Absolutely not. I don't think that I should be giving that kind of advice. I don't really think it's a medical thing, and I don't think that it's that I would say to a patient calling in the middle of the night, you know, take two aspirin, say a prayer, and call me in the morning. It just doesn't seem to be right, because religion really is a way of looking at the world as opposed and living and being in the world as opposed to just being another risk factor or another treatment modality or something of that sort.
Excuse me. Do you ask your patients about their faith life or their belief system, or that is that part of your history taking or your
a great question. It's a question that begs another question: Number one, should I? And if we answer that in the affirmative, then how do you go about doing it? The real simple and least invasive way is that when patients fill out a questionnaire, there's a place up at the top or somewhere on that questionnaire, religious preference or something. If somebody wants to write something, often it's none or it's left blank or it's Christian or Catholic or Jewish or whatever people might write. It depends on the patient, on the disease, on the setting. Somebody's coming in with a sprained ankle. It really doesn't matter whether they're particularly religious or not, or whether they're having a spiritual crisis in their lives. If they're dealing with a diagnosis of cancer for the first time, if they're facing an end-of-life issue, to be hooked to a machine or not to be hooked to a machine, then those discussions come up. But how any one physician or any one caregiver or even as a chaplain deals with those issues, it's very difficult because some people, a third of people, and it's been looked at. I'm going to sound like a third and a third and a third. You already don't believe, right? Immediately don't believe.
We know where that
statistic came from. But it is right that a third of individuals really don't want their physician to explore that with them. But two thirds, certainly a majority of individuals would like, when asked, do you want your doctor to know about it and to ask about it and to understand where you're coming from spiritually? Two-thirds of individuals would like their physician to have at least some appreciation for that. Physicians have some problems dealing with it. Yes, go ahead.
Now that you're retired, would it be easier for it to interject on your own something like that about religion or their prayer or if somebody's having a problem? Or you would not, as a practicing, well, you still are practicing, but I just thought, as you're walking around your farm and such, and somebody might be saying something, and would it be easy for you to interject something about religion then? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I don't know whether, it's a good question. With some people it's very easy to talk about it, it's very obvious that it's easy to talk about it. And with some, it is just much more difficult. I don't know how do you feel. Do you want your physicians to ask you?
But this is not a physician necessarily.
I don't think quite often when they, at least I've come across that when they fill out the form to be seen for the first time by a physician or appointment. Quite often there is a little thing: what is your faith, or of what faith or religion? Do you have a religion? And I think quite often that may be used for if they are in a critical situation, that they are able to call on some chaplain or something, or the family is able to tie in. I think that is one of the reasons they have that quite often on some information sheets that you fill out in the hospital or physician's office.
Did you remember you invited me to speak of cancer bracelets?
I'm sorry? I forgot all about it.
Oh,
I am sorry. We're gonna switch gears for 5 minutes here. And I'll give you the floor. This is
Leah
from the bookstore who is herself a cancer survivor and who has been working with the American Cancer Society and wants to just talk about a program that she's been involved in. And you have 5 minutes. And I apologize to you, and I apologize
That's
to
okay.
interrupt
I'm
the...
I'm just going to be late to work, and I don't want to be late to work, so I better ask. I just, you know, what you're discussing, when I battled cancer 6 years ago, the biopsy was awful. It was all cancer. They got no clean margins. The tumor that they removed, you know, as a biopsy procedure. And we had a healing service at our church. It was the first one we'd ever had. We had a new pastor. This is an ELCA church, so we weren't used to that. And
what kind of
church? Pardon me?
What's ELCA? Could you tell us about
Evangelical Lutheran.
Well, it's what our camp is owned by. It's like St. Olaf Concordia, all our church colleges.
Lutheran
Church. I'm an only child, and we have two sons, and they were both in college, and it was finals. This was the very, very end of April, and so I said to the boys, do not come home Sunday morning for this healing service. You will help me more if you stay at Wartburg and Luther and study for your finals. You know, a mother wanting them to do well on their finals. And I said to my husband, who's going to be there? I have no brothers or sisters. My husband has one sister. She was on a medical mission trip in Peru. You know, it was like, and then I said, oh, it doesn't matter. God will be there. And that's all that matters. And there were over 100 people who came. And it was like being at your own funeral. You know, kids I'd had in confirmation, kids I'd had in vacation Bible school. Who, you know, it was, I'd had them maybe 3 years ago, maybe 6 years. You know what I'm saying? But they came. And so when you're talking about intercessory prayer, Cliff, I say it's powerful. God does hear us when we pray as a group about a person, about a need. And then my surgeon, Dr. Allgood, don't you love that name?
Allgood?
Yes, and that is true. That is his name. And he asked Neil and me, the last appointment we had with him, I have asthma, so I was a very bad surgical candidate. I had a raging case of bronchitis at the time, and they weren't hesitating. I'd had gallbladder surgery in January, and they'd waited 3 months to do that because I had a sinus infection. And they, you know, didn't want to give me an anesthetic until that sinus infection. Well, now I've got bronchitis, which is way worse, and we're just going right straight ahead to this cancer surgery. And Dr. Allgood asked my husband and me and our sons if we would like him to pray with us the morning of surgery before we went into surgery. And we said, yes, yes, thank you, thank you. And radiology oncologist prayed with us after they'd done a body scan because I had a frozen shoulder at the time. You probably think I'm a walking rack. I'm all fine. It's all over now. I'm good. But anyway, the orthopedic doctor that I was seeing was absolutely positive that was cancer. It was breast cancer that I had been diagnosed with, and the right breast was my left shoulder that it was frozen. And so the orthopedic doctor was sure that was cancer, and so they had to do a body scan. And then Neil and I were waiting for the report from that, and the radiation oncologist came in and he said, Boyds, I have good news for you. The cancer is in that breast, and that's the only place it is, and everything else is clear. And he sat down and was visiting with us, and he said, would you like to share a prayer? Yes, we would. Yes, we would. And we walked out of the clinic that day, which was 4 days before surgery, and we were holding hands, and it was April, and the apple trees were in blossom. And we just looked at each other, and we said, one thing we know, we are in the right place. We've got physicians who are connected to the real physician. And wow, what assurance that gave us. You know, it just was, it was tremendous. And that was 6 years ago, and so now what I'd like to share with you is I am on a Relay for Life team in Forest City, Iowa. It's the Winnebago County Courthouse Relay for Life team. So I don't work at the courthouse, but they invited me to be on their team. And we've started making bracelets. We have made and sold since a year ago, April, the middle of April, 2005. We have made and sold over 3,000 of these. The American Cancer Society has designated different colors for different cancers, and so we have 12 colored beads on each bracelet, and those represent 12 different kinds of cancer as designated by the American Cancer Society. The bracelets cost $15, and $9 of that goes directly to the American Cancer Society. To find this cure, we have to have. I have found, since I have battled cancer, that cancer doesn't respect age. We have babies who have cancer. We have two-year-old children who have brain cancer. It doesn't respect sex, nationality. It's such a common denominator, and it's such a helpless feeling when we are faced with cancer, but there is something that every one of us can do, and maybe it is buying a bracelet. Maybe it is giving many cancer bracelets as Christmas presents, which is giving twice, giving to the American Cancer Society, giving to the person you give the bracelet to. Maybe it's making the bracelets. Maybe it's walking in the race for the cure. Whatever. This is just one thing that I can do, and I wanted to share the opportunity with you. I'm going to just quickly take a quick look. Each bracelet is different because of the spacer beads on them. And they do have the 12 colored beads. They also have a sterling silver charm, breast cancer bold charm on them. And so some people...
So if someone would like to purchase one, they would see you at the bookstore to do that? I mean, we're not going to purchase them here, but...
No, I'm not selling this morning right here at all. But they are available in the bookstore. Okay. So take a quick look at them, and if it's something that you might be interested in, they are available in the bookstore.
And what are your hours today? You don't know.
Well, I mean, you have still the regular
hours, like 5:30 to 6:30, okay. In addition to the regular hours.
Right. Okay. Yeah. 9 to 12, 1 to 4:30, and then 5:30 to 6:30 tonight and tomorrow night. Those hours are today and tomorrow morning. And Saturday we are open. So. Thank you, Cliff,
Leah, so much. I wish I could stay. Well, thank you for sharing your story. It's a tremendous, and it's absolutely the timing. Couldn't have been better.
No, I'm sitting there, and you're talking about intercessory prayer, and I'm saying, oh my goodness.
The Lord brought you to your
Yeah, I think so. Thanks. I bought one of these.
Yes, Kay would like, would you be willing to stand up and be our model, Kay?
Oh, yeah.
Karen. Looking at Kay.
It's okay, there's another Kay there.
And I forgot to put mine on this morning. But I have one too.
Both Karens have one.
See?
If you're named Karen, you have to have a bracelet.
They are very nice.
Well, thank you again, Leah, for coming and sharing your very personal story and a very touching story, and one totally timing and everything else was just right at the right time.
Before we continue on, I'd like to give a different spin to this. You had mentioned that there's all these statistics, et cetera, and yet when you get to the prayer part, you're not really comfortable with statistics. And the reason for that is that all these statistics are all very left brain, very cognitive things that most of us live by our whole world, you know. The stoplight is red, so we stop. It's green, and we go. It's yellow, and we wonder what about to go. Anyway. All things that are left brain are very measurable in some way. The right brain is not measurable, and that's where prayer comes in. The right brain is affective. It's where the emotions lie. It has a lot of characteristics that are exactly the opposite of the left brain, and it's, you just simply can't measure it. You feel it. You can see it with your eyes. Sometimes you can't even describe it in words. And so I think that's why it's difficult to talk about prayer, which is on the right side of the brain. Very, very difficult to put it in. It doesn't fit over here. It just doesn't. And I mean, if you want to convince somebody who's left-brained, I guess maybe that it works. Maybe you'd want to translate that over, but actually it doesn't belong there. That's why it's so hard to even talk about it or describe it. And that's why so many of us can't even describe what prayer is for us. It is, I know it's a connection to God, but how we get there and how we do it is really up to our own internal words, the way that we're put together and the way that we reach out. So I just wanted to put that spin on it.
Well spoken, Mary. But I think that based upon what you just sharing is then substantiated in John, in the book of John, where it talks about that the Spirit comes and the Spirit goes. As the wind starts and leaves, we never know when it stops and when it goes. Mm-hmm. And that's what the prayer stuff is all about, mm-hmm. because it is so Spirit-oriented that we don't know where it will go. It is all directed by the Holy Spirit, I believe, mm-hmm. and God, I mean, how that all works out.
That's right.
So it comes and goes. Yes?
Well, I just wanted to mention that about 2 years ago I had cataract surgery, and I was really surprised when I was laying there ready to be operated on, the surgeon prayed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess he does that for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those kind of behaviors on the part of the physician, a generation ago, would have probably been reported to his local medical But today, it occurs, and people have favorable images generally.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, some people would be very
threatened. It made me feel really good.
If you had been a Muslim, and your Christian physician was praying, you might not have felt that way.
Well, I think the prayer he said could have applied.
No, there is a sensitivity
yes.
that a physician has a certain amount of power, has a lot of power over a patient, in terms of influence, and one has to be very, very careful about how that influence is used and that you don't overstep your boundaries. I am not trained to teach anything about religion. Or to impose religion, or to even guide somebody as far as religion goes. My training, my expertise, and the reason that I'm allowed even to talk to somebody in a professional way is, and I'm licensed to do that, is because I have a certain amount of training and expertise and background and experience in a very different field in
mm-hmm.
medicine.
No,
now these they overlap, mm-hmm. but I think we have to be careful. And I think this is the danger. If you had a very uniform society and everyone was a Lutheran or everyone was a Catholic or everyone was a Muslim or whatever it was, then you can tie those things in together and probably have a very effective healing relationship. But when you have a diverse society with people of very, very different beliefs, incompatible beliefs, we don't see that here, but there are beliefs that are out there, as you all know, that are completely incompatible with each other. And to have a physician who has very strong beliefs in one system and not in another, one has to be very, very careful that is not interpreted in a negative way by the patient and create a situation of tension which would adversely affect that person's mm-hmm. health or outcome or progress with the disease. Yes?
Yeah, my sister's experience down in Portland, she is at a nursing home right now, and her doctor came in and asked her if she would like for him to pray, and she could have said, no, I'm a Muslim or I'm whatever, and would not like that. So he gave her the option. Of,
yes.
Mm-hmm. He didn't impose.
And our chaplain, we have a great chaplain in Corvallis, and he does exactly that. Mm-hmm. His prayers, firstly, are pretty he's Episcopalian, mm-hmm. but they're pretty non-denominational prayers to start with. But it's mm-hmm. always, would you like me to pray? Would you like to pray with me? Would you like me to pray for you? Would you? And so it's always with a permission.
I think he did ask. Would you mind if I pray?
Yeah. Carol, would you like me to?
Carol.
I was just going to say, I think that, you know, from the, you know, from the medical community to the people, a better question might be, instead of what religion are you, or be, what is your support? Where does your support come from? What supports you? I think that would more open the conversation. And prayer, to me, is not just words. I mean, it can be touch, it can be, you know, all kinds of connections.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a beautiful, that was beautifully stated. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that you mentioned power, the idea of being the powerful one in this situation, and that's true in the classroom too, where you're in the public school, where you have to be careful about.
Good point.
Neil? In my experience, when I've worked with people that are on the disaster sites, my question is, are you a person of faith? And that seems to be able to say, no, yes, I am. And that opens up the door. The other thing I want to share is that as you need to be disciplined as a physician in how far you go, so does the minister or the theologian need to be disciplined so that they don't walk into the field, the medical field, trying to interpret something that, and that happens sometimes in some church groups where the minister really lacks that discipline and begins to interpret a particular illness because of one cause or another.
We started out this discussion yesterday talking about the priest and the physician being one, and so I'd just like to maybe close this as we move on to another area with a quote. The priest and the physician are no longer one and the same person as they were in biblical times. However, the services each provides should complement and supplement each other for the benefit of the patient and the patient's total physical and mental well-being during health and illness and at the end of life. So I think we have complementary roles to share. The boundaries have to be kept reasonably clear, although at times they will be fuzzy. Good discussion. I mentioned yesterday that I would tell you a little more about my friend. Those of you in the poetry part of this have heard a little bit about this, and whether we believe in intercessory prayer or not, or whether it's been proved to be scientifically useful or not scientifically useful, I would like for those of you who feel comfortable to in the course of the day today and at Vespers tonight to offer prayers to my friend. And I'm just going to tell you a little bit about him and why he is so important to me and why he and his wife are so important to Gay and me. The first reason is that besides Gay, he is the most influential person in my life. He was born, it almost sounds mythical. He was born on an Indian reservation, the son of a Mennonite pastor, and grew up in a very pacifist society where he grew up. He and his older brother both wanted to be doctors, and in the late 1930s, they flipped a coin. Paul was the older brother, Dave was the younger brother, and they both wanted to go to medical school, and they didn't have the money to do it. And they flipped the coin to see who would go to medical school and who would go get a job to support the other. Okay. The older brother won the coin toss. Maybe they tossed it three or four times until the older brother won, but the older brother did. And he applied to and was accepted at Harvard Medical School, the older brother. And David had to get a job. And there weren't a lot of jobs then. It's still Depression time. So he joined the Marine Corps. Actually was a naval aviator. Trained at Pensacola, became a fighter pilot, and was stationed in San Diego for a while with Pappy Boynton's group. And so he flew, he was one of Pappy Boynton's, you know, the Baba Black Sheep people of World War II. So he flew, that was before they were the Baba Black Sheep. They were just kind of a bunch of wild guys down there. And David didn't entirely fit in, because these guys were heavy drink. This is a Mennonite. And so, a pacifist, he's a Marine fighter pilot, and they were kind of wild guys there. In 1941, he was stationed in Hawaii with his Marine pilot squadron at the time of Pearl Harbor. They were not in Pearl Harbor. He was subsequently, the following week, they shipped out and went to Wake Island. To defend Wake, because they knew Wake was going to be one of the first places that Japan was going to attack. And they were out there, a relatively small group of Marines. They had eight airplanes out there on Wake Island to defend that island, a few hundred men. And the U.S. Navy sent a convoy out to relieve them, to provide them with supplies and ammunition, because they knew the attack was coming. They ran into some Japanese U-boats and turned around and went back to Hawaii. So they had no support coming in, and they knew they had no support coming in. Japanese attacked, were repulsed,
with very heavy casualties. They attacked the second time, and the island was overrun. David fought hand-to-hand, ended up killing a Japanese soldier in his foxhole that he was defending, and has lived with that his rest of his life. He was taken prisoner and shipped back to Japan, and served in a prisoner of war camp for 3.5 years in Japan. Just as an aside, because this says something about one of the things that has been so painful for David this past 3 or 4 years with Guantanamo Bay, and he's been a prisoner of war. He knows what it's like. He knows that his life was saved because of the Geneva Conventions. When they were taken prisoner, about 110 Marines on Wake Island, they were lined up and they were stripped. They had barbed wire holding their hands behind their backs. And the Japanese, and of course the Japanese had suffered heavy casualties in taking the island, so they were obviously angry. They were setting up the machine gun to kill them all. And the Japanese admiral, this was a big thing at the time. The Wake Island was a big battle early in the war. And it was a Japanese colonel was going to, was giving the order to fire the machine guns, and the admiral just arrived off the main ship. And they got into a fight. The admiral and the colonel were yelling at each other in Japanese, and David didn't know what was going on. The Americans were standing there, didn't know what was happening. And the fight, the colonel was upset. They took the machine guns down. They loaded these guys onto the boat and took them back to Japan. It turned out years later, David was to find out that the admiral was in fact the chief of all Pacific operations for the Japanese Navy at the time, had been educated in France. And it turned out that this man was a very strong proponent of the Geneva Conventions. And David says that his life was saved because of this little exchange that went on. That's just kind of an aside. And so you can probably imagine the struggle that has been going through when his own country, the country he fought to defend, is saying the Geneva Conventions don't apply. Anyway, that's an aside. 4 years prisoner of war camp, contracts tuberculosis, comes back, applies to medical school, is accepted at Harvard Medical School, becomes a physician, meets his wife in New York at Cornell Medical Center, has his education interrupted twice because his TB relapses. He's 108, he's 6 foot something, 180 pounds when he's captured. He comes out at less than 120 pounds with active tuberculosis. Anyway, make a long story short, this man is a pacifist. He protested the war in Vietnam by sending his Silver Star. He won Silver Star, Purple Heart, all kinds of awards in World War II. Sent a Silver Star back to President Nixon in protest of the Vietnam War, has been a shining light to me. He introduced me to Holden Village. We did the first Elder Hostel group up here with David and his son Peter, who was the medic here for a whole year. And David has been a shining light to me, somebody that has lived his life the way all of us would like to live our lives, and has had a depth of experience that very few people have had. His patients loved him. He set a wonderful example. He has congestive heart failure. He's 89 years of age. As recently as 2 Septembers ago, we bicycled, Gay and I and David and his wife, in the Gulf Islands. The Gulf Island, just the north of the San Juan Islands in Canada. And he, at the age of 87 at the time, he rode his bike. Our longest day, it wasn't a terribly long day, but it was 28 miles in the pouring rain. And he just bicycled right along and did it. Quite a guy. But he's going to die soon of his congestive heart failure. And his days are pretty miserable as he tries to come to terms with his own impending death and what that means and what that's going to mean for his family and his friends. And it's still a struggle for him. You'd think
how
that.
How do you feel when you have congestive heart failure? I mean, I know you probably have trouble breathing.
He has trouble breathing. He's very, very weak. He's very weak. Just has no energy.
Feet and legs swell.
His whole life, his whole world has changed. You go into his house now, and we visited him just before we left for Holden Village. We stopped by and thinking that maybe we wouldn't see him again. I don't know. But his house, you know, in the living room now is a hospital bed and a commode, and you know, everything has just changed. This guy, and you see pictures of him when he was 27 years old in his Marine flight jacket, standing next to one of his fighter planes, and it's just a phenomenal story, and it's what life's all about. Anyway, if you feel so inclined, and I know in the poetry class we're going to write little notes to David, what you know about him, just from what I've told you, very, very special man.
Could you spell his last name?
It's K-L-I-E-W-E-R. It's a Dutch name. And that's, you only heard of one little part of his life. I mean, there were so many other aspects of his life that are just...
You would have to have a month of sessions.
Yeah, it would take a long time to tell you some of the unbelievable things that he's experienced in his life and the things he's done. Yes?
Definitely sounds like the person who would like to live, like to have lived till 120.
Yeah, he is. He's the kind of person that has a lot of wisdom.
But you know, I think he's ready to go right now.
Yes.
I really do. I, having talked with him, I think he's ready to die.
Mm-hmm. And yet,
his wife is having a
that's not a bad thing.
No, I think
we don't feel bad. We don't
he's
feel
at
bad
the
about
season
him.
He's at
dying.
The time he's at the end of his life, and he realizes it, and she realizes it, and they both know it.
And what is her name?
Pardon me?
What is her name?
Jean.
Well, thank you for indulging me. If it hadn't been for Dave Cleaver, I would not be here today. Not alive. Although you know, he didn't do everything perfectly. I'll have to tell you something. I'll tell you one little story because it relates to me, because he was my doctor. I have been his physician for a number of years, and he was my physician as well. So it's wild relationship, you know. We're friends. We've been each other's physicians. He's my mentor, my teacher, my spiritual advisor. He's all those things, and so it's a kind of a unusual relationship, or relationships. But I contracted an illness when I was 33 years old. I'd been in Central Oregon and came back and thought I had the. It was in March. Thought I had the flu. I had a high fever, 104 temperature, sicker than a dog, So I'll get over this. 2 or 3 days later, I was feeling better. Temperature was down. I went back to work. Within 24, 48 hours, I was sick again. Temperature was back up to 103. Feeling sick. Got better again. Went back to work again. Temperature went back up 104. And I was really feeling pretty bad. And Dave came out. He actually made a house call. That gives you another idea what a great doctor he was. Came out to see me in my home, in my bed. And said, you know, you've... it doesn't look good. He really didn't think I was doing well. He thought I might have some, like Hodgkin's disease, with something called a Pell-Epstein fever that comes up and down, and they were making arrangements to get me hospitalized and having some tests done, and I was feeling kind of really depressed. And they did some additional blood tests. It turned out I had been infected with Borrelia. Now, Borrelia is a strange bacteria that causes relapsing fever. My fever keeps relapsing. What do you think it might be? What might be this relapsing? Well, that's the name of the disease, relapsing fever. And if he only made the diagnosis, or if he had just been a good GP would have just given me some antibiotics. You got a fever, take some antibiotics. You know, you're not supposed to do that, but people do that. They would have cured me. But instead, he waited until all these things went along because he was being a good academic, scientific doctor. That he was. So he missed that diagnosis, but still just a great...
He's still
great
alive, though.
I'm still alive. Still alive and still here. All right, well, we're going
to
go...
It sounds like somebody that would have been nice to have written a book about his life, or has he done it?
Oh, yeah.
He's writing his own memoirs.
He's working on it.
And you bring up something that makes me feel very guilty. About 15 years ago, I told... I told him that when I retired, I was going to write his story with him, sit down with him, interview him to get the information. And I kind of never really retired, and I never really followed through on that. I feel kind of bad about that, because his story is one that really should be told. It should be documented.
But he's currently writing it.
He has written a lot of it.
Well, you know, consider that oral history is just as powerful as the written history. Consider that. It may not go as far. People won't read it on the East Coast or hear you, but wherever you go, he is there in your oral. Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to leave the realm of the left brain, which is where we have been dwelling for the past two and a half, three sessions, when we talked about healthcare and financing and all the things you should do to live a long life. I mean, that's really left brain stuff, isn't it?
It is.
Now we're going to get into ethics and aesthetics and other kinds of
every
issues.
Every time we switch topics, Jay takes off another layer of clothing.
I think we have to. There's a limit to this. I know. You would notice those things.
She's got relaxing fever.
I've got relapsing fever. Yeah. If only a doctor could make my diagnosis.
Yeah, that's right.
I want to see the outline.
I got notes. Boy, do I have notes. You know, I don't know whether any of it's worth talking about. But we're gonna talk a little bit about medical ethics, and we've been kind of concentrating on this on the science, and now we're gonna talk a little bit about ethics. And I have put up, I guess, a couple caveats. Number one is that I am not an ethicist. I'm not a philosopher. I'm a physician, so I am walking out into areas that I don't have a lot of expertise. That won't stop me from being very dogmatic and my usual way of presenting things, but. Take even more than what you've done in the past, take what I say with a grain of salt, because I'm not really an expert at all in this area. When we talk about ethics and moral philosophies and the ways of viewing the world from a medical point of view, things come down to a relatively small number of a small number of principles, and I've listed those principles up on the board. And virtually every moral dilemma in medicine, and probably most moral dilemmas and quandaries that we face in life, can kind of come down to some four basic principles. And one of them is beneficence. That means to do good. See, I would never use a word like beneficence. I don't talk that way, but the philosophers and ethicists do. And even worse than beneficence is non-maleficence. I really try to follow non-maleficence. What in the world is that? That means to do no harm. And as a physician, that's the big thing. First, primum non nocere, first, do no harm. Autonomy, that's the respect for individuals as people, as persons, respect for personhood. And the individual, the right to and the obligation to have that respect and to allow people to make their own decisions, and justice, and that can be distributive justice is how are we gonna spread the wealth or spread services around and do it in a way that reflects justice. I think I know you all have a pretty good idea about what we're talking about, doing good, not doing wrong. From a scientific point of view, we want evidence for the things that we are doing that they really do good, not just that somebody said they did good. And we kind of had some discussions last night about, you know, what if somebody says that echinacea cures colds and infections, and sure enough, somebody says that. Does that mean it's right? We want some evidence that this is in fact. If I'm going to prescribe that, if I'm going to do that, that it really is good, and we don't want things to have side effects and harm that's greater than good that comes out of it. The issues of justice are much more difficult as to how one allocates things. Who gets what? When do they get it? How do they get it? A number of philosophers have dealt with that. Probably most people nowadays accept the teachings of John Stuart Mill, who talked about the greatest good. So we want to get the greatest good. We want to get the bang for the buck. We want to do how we allocate things to the greatest good. Those of us that grew up with Star Trek, Mr. Spock, a great philosopher actually, the needs of the many, Captain, outweigh the needs of the few. Right, now that's what he's, that's what we heard, and that was right. That was one way of looking at it. Another way is if we look at I'm getting into areas that I can talk about.
Egalitarianism.
That's it. Thank you.
Egalitarianism.
Okay, we're all entitled to equal to equal services, or hyper egalitarianism, or whatever it is. And that is if it's not going to be available to everybody, it shouldn't be available to anybody. That's hyper. There's a concept. If everybody can't get a heart transplant, then nobody should get a heart transplant. We shouldn't just allocate it according to need. And then there are just some, decent minimum standards as to what people, everybody should get a minimum standard, and then people can will allocate other things on a different method. Maybe first come, first serve. Maybe those people that seem to be of greatest value to society would get more than someone that doesn't. A lottery. Those people that have the greatest likelihood of success. So these are big issues in transplant and allocation of organs. Bad enough with money, but money would kind of spread it around, and the government can always print more money, but we don't have more hearts, and we don't have more lungs, and we don't have more kidneys. And who gets those? Because they're very scarce, and so that's when we get into those kinds of...
of an example is Irma Brombeck. She had, kidney failure, wasn't it? And she was on, needed a transplant, and she would not go ahead of the line. She would wait her turn.
Whereas Mickey Mantle got...
He got to the head of the line.
The week after he hit the papers.
Yeah, and so did the governor of Pennsylvania, who got a liver and a heart, I think, or maybe a liver and two kidneys. I forgot what he got, but he got to the top of the line. But there is a national transplant. I forgot to say it's a uniform. It has a series of letters that does allocate organs in the United States right now. But there's a lot of competition in these different programs. And if you really want to get into it, and there was just an article in the newspaper not very long ago about the biggest producer of organs for transplant in the world right now is China. And it's because they take the organs of the people who are executed for crimes. And they're selling those. I mean, they're not allocating according to... the need, they're actually being sold. I believe it's true. You sometimes take a lot of what you read in the newspapers for a grain of salt. But this great ethical thing, if we're going to execute somebody, and there are three countries that account for the majority of execution in the world. You know what those three countries are?
U.S.,
China, and Iran. Isn't it nice to be in that group? We execute, those three countries execute the majority of people that are executed on Earth right now, legally executed. I mean, where there's wars and where you don't know what's happening in killer death squads and all that kind of stuff, and that's a whole other issue. Should we be, if we're going to execute, Jose Rodriguez down in Texas, who... I just made up that name because I was just going to use that. It isn't
the white Americans that get, the white Anglos that get executed, it's the blacks and the Hispanics that get executed. If we're going to execute him, and he's got, he's 28 years old, and he's got good kidneys and a good heart and good lungs and a good liver, mm-hmm. should we take him?
If he donates them, yeah.
What if he doesn't even want to die?
Yeah.
Let alone donate his organs. I've never heard of a prisoner donating his organs. I don't even know if they've given a chance. Yeah. But that is an ethical issue to talk about. Yeah. I mean, if you needed the heart transplant, you might say, yeah, you know, I mean, you're going to kill this guy. Why just bury the organ? You know, I mean, what's the point?
Yeah, why waste it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but...
How about arresting and convicting people that aren't even guilty of any crimes?
Another.
Yeah.
Then China. No, I'm serious.
Oh, no, in China.
Political,
yeah. Well,
dissidents.
All political prisoners
political
or
dissidents.
Whatever else.
Yes,
go ahead.
Another offshoot of that ethical question is, should physicians be involved in executions?
Good question. Well, should physicians? That, what do you think the American Medical Association says? In the Code of Ethics of the American Medical Association.
No.
Right-wing, conservative organization.
The law
that,
of the land go along with it.
No, they don't.
Good.
It's considered. It's considered unethical by the American Medical Association, whatever that's worth, to participate in any way in an execution.
So,
and yet physicians do, I mean, but you know, because it's required in that physicians, you know, have to actually prescribe the drug.
If they don't have a physician present to make sure that that lethal injection does work right away, because then it could be cruel and unusual punishment and all this stuff. So they
and that's before the Supreme Court right now, or it has been. I don't know if they ruled on that. Does anybody help me on that? The Florida case that where someone was saying that the lethal injection is not painless, and that there's a period of time where people can't breathe and have a sense that they can't breathe, and that it is a very painful death. So the Supreme Supreme
Court. How is that proven? How do they know that?
Don't know.
Because if you're injected,
don't know.
You're
going to
die.
Can I? Yeah, go ahead. Yes. I mean,
some of the things I've read is that, I don't know about the injections. There's different methods of executing people. Mm-hmm. And certain things like with gas, sometimes the chemicals don't have the exact right mix. And so somebody is like gagging on it and everything, but it doesn't kill them, and so they have to turn it off, and then they have to redo it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the process goes on for a really long time, so it's basically torture. Mm-hmm. And all these different methods, I think they all have some
risk to be
some yes. Yeah. And it would be interesting to get this statistical analysis of to what extent somebody dies like within 1 or 2 seconds or something, and versus go through a period of up to an hour of being tortured, going through it and then having to be rescheduled to do it again, which I read about.
I think Utah has a firing squad, and I think that the firing, you know, that those are sharp shooters, and they hit for the heart. It's gone. But there's no pain there.
Yeah.
There's pain in the shooters.
Oh, right.
I think
you
got
to look at that.
Demonstrated effects on people who are involved in execution.
Oh, okay.
But there might be 5 people and only one has got the bullet.
To think that there's no pain when a bullet goes through your heart is not accurate.
Okay.
You don't die instantaneously. You may die within a matter of a minute or two. But you don't, and you may lose, you know, you may lose consciousness, but there's going to be a period of time. I mean, a bullet to the head would be much better. Why did we get into this? That wasn't exactly the way I thought this conversation was going to go. But anyway, we're going to take a couple comments, and let's take 5 minutes.
In terms of the numbers of executions that you were talking about, was the U.S. the highest?
No, I think China is the highest.
Of course,
China's got the biggest population.
And they do have some dissidents that they don't want.
They execute a lot of people in China, remarkably large number. And Iran executes a lot of people.
Do you know exactly?
No, I don't have the numbers. That was
I just want to send you to bring up a model that I found very helpful in moral theology and philosophy discussing these issues, that if you're going to have a discussion about setting up rules for something like distributive justice, who gets what, you set up all the rules before you know your position in the system.
So that is a wonderful point.
Yeah,
let's take a break. Let's just let that percolate a little bit.
5 minutes?
5 minutes.
This is a quick break.
Position in the system.